80 years ago, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. All over the world lie scattered pieces of her puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to the Chasing Earhart podcast. I'm your host and the project creator, Chris Williamson.
Hello and welcome to the Chasing Earhart podcast. This is your host, Chris Williamson. This is episode 13. We're happy to have you aboard and we have a great episode for you this week. Now we are coming to you live from Atchison, Kansas. I'm actually sitting in my office right now recording this, and it's a quote-unquote dark and stormy night in Atchison, Kansas. The weather is, we're deep into fall, and we're having a very interesting night with a lot of thunder and lightning. You may even hear some of it in the background, even on the external microphones that we're using to record this. So it's a really interesting atmosphere, and we're deep into fall in Atchison, Kansas. I wanted to talk a little bit about what we've been doing and what we've been up to in the last week or so since we last met. Last weekend, as you all know, we hosted Pan Am Chairman of the Board, Tim Mellon, in Atchison, Kansas. Tim was kind enough to fly out here and donate some of his time to speak with us and show us some very interesting video footage and to actually record his interview for the Chasing Earhart documentary. We're very honored and privileged to have Tim here with us. And we just want to send a very special thank you to Mr. Mellon, and we hope to work with him along more in the future. We're going to actually have him be recording his episode of the podcast coming up shortly here, and we're very excited to have his perspective and his expertise involved in Chasing Earhart. Now I want to move on to our website. For the folks who have been visiting our website lately, some of the repeat folks who come to the website, you'll notice that our website has drastically changed. It has a very different look and appeal. And we're very happy and proud of the new website. The website before was sort of a case study for the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and her life. But we have sort of, now that we've gotten into the second phase of the project and we're starting to really drill down into recording and shooting the documentary and recording the podcast, we decided to turn the website into really a showcase for Chasing Earhart and our team and the podcast itself and the news that's actually being done regarding the actual project. So you'll notice on the website we've got a news tab, and on that tab you can see sort of who we've shot with so far as we shoot. We like to put a lot of behind the scenes images up there on the website so folks can get an idea of kind of how the documentary is going to look and kind of the process that we're going through when shooting it. And as I mentioned earlier, it's also the home of the Chasing Earhart podcast. So while you can listen to the podcast on iTunes and Google Play and pretty much every other platform out there on the market, the Chasing Earhart website, chasingearhart.com, is really the home of the podcast, and that's where most of our listens happen, and most of our project followers and project members sort of go to the website to listen to the actual podcast week after week. So if you haven't already, head over to the website, check it out. Let us know what you think of the brand new look and feel, and subscribe to the mailing list. The mailing list is free. We have some very special things coming up in the next couple of months that you'll want to be part of the mailing list and the subscription list for. In addition to getting each episode of the podcast 24 hours before everybody else gets it, you're going to get some very special opportunities in the coming months to do something really cool with us. So chasingearhart.com, and just wait for a few seconds and you can subscribe. You'll see the pop-up on there. Or of course, you can always scroll down to each to the bottom of each page and you can subscribe that way as well. Okay, so now on to this week's guest. So we've actually spoke to Sylvia Wrigley a little while back, probably a couple of months ago. We conducted this interview, and it's a fascinating interview. She wrote a really neat book on Amelia Earhart called Unable to Reach You by Radio. If you click on the show notes link, you'll be able to actually look at that book and purchase a copy of it for yourself. It's a very quick read on Amelia Earhart, but it's a very fascinating read. Sylvia is an expert in aviation accidents and crash investigation, and she's just a really great wealth of knowledge for the Chasing Earhart project to kind of speak on all the things that maybe went into the world flight and some of the issues that kind of occurred that contributed to the end of the world flight. And she's a very fascinating individual to speak to on that ground, and we're very honored and happy to have her. So without further ado, let's get into this really interesting interview, and let's talk with Sylvia Wrigley. Sylvia, you're up. Our guest today on the Chasing Earhart podcast is author Sylvia Wrigley. Sylvia is an accident investigator. She's an expert in aviation accident investigation and why planes crash. She's written a couple of books on that subject. And the book we're going to talk to her about in particular today is a book that she wrote, which I love the title for. It's called Unable to Reach You by Radio. And we're really going to get into Amelia Earhart and the world flight and what she believes happened. But first, I want to welcome Sylvia. Thank you so much for joining us on the Chasing Your Heart podcast. It's really an honor to have you aboard.
Oh, I'm really glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
So I want to start this this interview the same way I start every interview I do. Can you tell everybody a little bit about your education and your professional background?
Okay, sure. I studied journalism in college. And then in the 1990s, there was this newfangled thing called the internet. And the press didn't really know what to make of it or how to make sense of it. So I became, I like to call it almost a translator. I started writing articles trying to explain internet and technical issues and computer issues for a mainstream audience. And that set me up really well for later when I started writing about aviation, because the same skill of making sense of something and then turning it into plain English without oversimplifying and without throwing away facts, which is, you know, sometimes a problem. So that was sort of the route to aviation. My actual professional background is in marketing and in writing.
So can you tell everybody how Amelia Earhart came into your life?
Sure. As a female pilot, there's no way you don't come in contact with Amelia Earhart. It's, you know, it's just a constant conversation that people like to bring up and discuss and what happened, and you're not going to get lost, are you? And, you know, all kinds of different references. She's also a really amazing woman. So there was always this kind of background knowledge of Amelia Earhart and what happened, and she got lost, and you know, are we going to find any traces of the wreckage or anything? And then at some point, I started looking a bit deeper, and I think it was after MH370, and there was this whole thing of how can a plane disappear? How, you know, what's happening here? And so I started looking at more examples, and the Amelia Earhart, I was really completely intrigued as to how much I didn't know, how little I actually knew about it. And then I was super excited to find out that the accident report is online. So, you know, one of the things I do a lot is look at accident reports and analyze them and translate them into here are the important points. So take a 150-page document, distill it down to a few pages. And then here was this wonderful, wonderful, you know, accident report from Amelia Earhart and with all the CAB details. And so that was really the start where I just started getting very into it. And then I found TIGAR, and they have amazing amount of documents online. They have amazing amount of analysis, and they have their own agenda, which is great, but they're very clear about what they want to do and how they're trying to find or to prove where they think the plane landed. So, but again, a wonderful resource. And so I just went down this rabbit hole, and it was like, I couldn't talk about anything but Amelia for weeks, you know, and that was kind of the start.
Yeah. I think that's interesting, because a lot of people, they kind of share the same story in various backgrounds. They'll start investigating the Earhart disappearance, and then they'll go down this rabbit hole, and they just kind of get enthralled by the story. And that's kind of what's made a lot of people fans of the Earhart disappearance and you know, become their own theorists and their own hypothesis and all that stuff. So it's very interesting.
Makes sense.
So you did write a book called Unable to Reach You by Radio. It's a very unique title. Can you tell everybody how you came up with that title?
Yeah, it was effectively one of the last transmissions that we have of Earhart is where the radio issues have become very clear. And the call itself was, we must be on you, but cannot see you. Gas is running low. Been unable to reach you by radio. We are flying at an altitude of 1,000 feet. And that one radio call has so much in it. She knows there's something wrong. She knows that they should be able to see the ship. They should be able to see Howland. And that, for me, really crystallized that moment when she must know this is not just not going to plan. There's something dreadfully wrong.
So what compelled you to go ahead and write this book and then put it out there?
I... I just kept finding out more and more, and I realized that a lot of people like me did not know a lot about what had happened or what the details were. And there's a huge interest in understanding mysteries and trying to make sense of them. And so for me, one of the things I wanted to do was to not try and come up with a solution. Here's what I think happened. And, you know, there is a real temptation to say, I have the true answer. And if you listen to me, I can prove it. And what I really wanted to do was show all the different pieces and say, right, now you decide what you think happened. Or, you know, here's all the information that seems pertinent. Because there's too much detail for any one person to say, unless they become briefly obsessed. There's way too much information for somebody to decide, I'm going to see, get all the facts together. So I just wanted to make a distilled version that could be read in one sitting. That was kind of my goal.
So I'm going to ask you a very, very straightforward question. I know this particular question I'm about to ask is, we could do podcast upon podcast on this one question alone, but is maybe there's a way for you to kind of synopsize, you know, why this happens, but why do planes crash most commonly? What happens and what causes it? Are there just a million different reasons, or are there, you know, maybe just a small handful of reasons that things go wrong?
There's definitely a million different reasons, but also there's a lot of different reasons for each individual crash. Aircraft are complex systems. And do you know the Swiss cheese model? Is that something you've looked at?
Mm-mm, no.
Okay, so the Swiss cheese model is about accidents and risk assessment. Basically, you imagine a slice of Swiss cheese with the holes in it, and then you take another slice and you put them together, and another slice and another slice, and those are all the different systems and all the different pieces, effectively. And so when there's a hole in the slice, very often the next slice will provide a barrier so that hole doesn't go through. And so it's got its own holes, but the next slice provides a barrier to those holes. And so in a complex system, you will always have mistakes, you will always have weak points. Those holes are the weak points, and all you can do is protect against them as much as possible. So when there's a plane crash, what's happened is the holes have lined up. So sometimes it happens. So it's not any single hole that you can say, this was the cause, this was the problem. It was, okay, these have all just lined up and now we have a tragedy. And even, I mean, now most planes don't crash, obviously. We talk about the plane crashes, we're interested in the plane crashes, but even in the 20s and 30s, when there were a lot more plane crashes, you still had this complex system where usually there were a number of things that came together. If you look at accident reports, the most common cause is pilot error. But that's a really unfair assessment, because the pilot is the last slice of the cheese. It is the absolute last chance we have of righting whatever has gone wrong in the past. So very often it's that final mistake, which is visible to us, but the final mistake shouldn't have mattered if the other holes weren't there.
And we'll get into that in a little bit, I think, in a little more detail. Your book focuses a lot on the radio communication aspect between the Electra and the Itasca. Can you give us a brief overview of just of those last several radio communications and transmissions between the two vessels?
Yeah. So the Electra was Earhart's aircraft, and it was her and Fred Noonan on board. Itasca was a U.S. Coast Guard patrol boat, and it was positioned to help the pair make it to Howland Island. And so the whole point was the navigation. And both the Electra and the U.S. Coast Guard ship had onboard direction finding equipment. And the point was to take bearing on radio signals. So the radio communications are critical, because that was how they were going to try to find out where each other were, which would give, I mean, the cutter obviously knew where it was, but it would give a boost to the navigation for Earhart and Noonan. The first transmissions came through nice and strong and clear, and Itasca reported them fine, but it became clear pretty quickly that Earhart wasn't hearing them. Her responses were still making contact, and at no point was she responding to what they said. She kept asking them to use the direction finder to provide a bearing for Noonan's navigation, and she never seemed to hear their responses. Now, they could tell by the broadcast initially that the Electra was heading towards them, and the Itasca kept trying to get through. But again, there was no point, and they knew where they were. It didn't help to find her. They needed to tell her what direction she needed to go to get to them. After the third transmission, where she clearly wasn't hearing, the Itasca started bellowing smoke, and they were trying to contact her with Morse code. They then attempted to use voice messages as well. Her radio calls became more and more urgent, and there was never any sign that she could hear them other than one single call. And in the end, all they heard was static.
Okay, so we'll get into a little bit of the radio communications, and we'll use your book as a guideline. So it's been argued by several folks that Miss Earhart changed her radio frequency to that of a military frequency just before she left Miami. Do you think, and there's a lot of speculation on this, but is there any particular reason why you feel she might have done that? Or do you think that she was told to do that? Or what do you think the story was there?
So first of all, I want to say I'm weak on the science of radio frequencies and the historical use of radio frequencies and why a specific frequency was good for a specific thing. But I'm much better at human factors. And looking at the system, it seems pretty clear Earhart chose the frequency she wished to use. And part of this, I think, is very much down to wanting to use voice messages, that she wanted to speak to people and use voice radio telephony, which was not common at the time. I think that the frequency she chose was based on not using standard practice, not using Morse code. And she was getting resistance, absolutely, from the military and from the Coast Guard, and people did, you know, had their systems which they wanted to use. So that's what I think, that her frequency choices were dictated by what was best for voice transmission rather than what was necessarily best for the flight.
Do you think, is there any reason why you believe that she may not have ever attempted the 500 kilohertz frequency? Like if she wasn't being heard on that frequency, or if it was a clear, as you mentioned earlier, a clear communication problem, that she might have just switched frequencies and gone back to a different one and try to talk to him that way?
Well, she did try to switch frequencies. She mentions switching frequencies in one of the radio calls, which it didn't seem to do any good. But the other thing is, there's definitely some confusion about whether some of the Electra's antenna had been removed. Certainly there was damage to one antenna. There was question about whether another one came off on takeoff. And there's one kind of weird theory that there were two Electra's, and one had antenna and one didn't. And you have to get kind of deep into it to make any sense as to why Earhart would have wanted two flights for her historic flight. So I don't put a lot of credence into that, but there's definitely, the conspiracy theory is based on the question of the antennas. So there's a question as to whether she had the capability to receive 500 kilohertz transmissions. My understanding is that she would have been dependent on high frequency direction finder. And so that would again dictated her choices. The 500 kilohertz, I mean, it would have been the correct frequency. It was the right frequency for calling ships at sea. It's the distress signal, the one that's now it's 121.5, and every pilot knows it, and pilots will dial it in and monitor the frequency. Well, then in the same way, 500 kilohertz, you know, any ship would be listening out. So it was 24/7 somebody listening, so it would have been the right place to be broadcasting. My feeling is if she never broadcast on that frequency, it was because she couldn't.
So it's been argued that the crew, in this case Miss Earhart, Mr. Noonan, lacked in knowledge when it came to radio communication. They were also explicitly at one point instructed not to change radio frequencies, but they did anyway. Was this a case of the crew perhaps just feeling that they knew best and just kind of knew what they wanted, and they were going to go with what they wanted at the end?
I think that it is pretty clear that she had a lack of understanding and knowledge about radio communications. She categorically didn't know Morse code, which was standard at the time. Noonan was not strong on radio communications, also did not know Morse code. And pretty much everyone they interacted with said that there was a problem here. But there's always this issue of you don't know what you don't know. So, you know, I think she well could have been making decisions not based necessarily on stubbornness, but as much as anything, not seeing that it was important. In fact, maybe even seeing that the aviators in the military were being stubborn when, you know, what she was asking wasn't that big a deal. But there's also very clear that when she when she said, I want to do this by voice and I want to do this at 7.5 kilohertz, there's absolutely the case that nobody on the task said, you know, this might cause problems, might not be able to do the direction finding. And they should have, you know. So whether everybody was digging their heels in by now or whether they just thought, well, that's what she's decided. And in the same way with the frequency change, I think, you know, maybe she was being stubborn. Maybe she just thought, well, look, this is what they originally told me to do, or this is what somebody told me to do, or maybe this was something I understood from Manning. You know, there's a million different things that could have been going through her head. And if you don't know, if you don't understand the detail, how do you know what's important? How do you know what's going to make the difference? So.
And that's a good segue. You touched on Morse code, so we'll kind of get into that a little bit. We know that there was to be Morse code equipment aboard the Electra. However, it was left behind, perhaps due to the fact that, you know, as you said, neither Miss Earhart or Mr. Noonan were proficient enough with it to warrant bringing it along, and there was a weight issue. Even at a slow pace of understanding, though, which some have argued that they did have, would it have behooved them to bring the equipment as a backup just in case, you know, primary communication failed like it did? Do you think that would have been something that they could have fallen back on and maybe at least given out an SOS or something like that?
I don't think so, because at this point she is transmitting. Being able to transmit something more or transmit an SOS wasn't going to help her. You know, the transmissions, what she needed was to be able to understand. And if somebody started doing Morse code at speed at her, as far as I can see, she wasn't going to understand. The day before at Ley Airport, the general manager said that both of them could only understand individual letters and they had to have them repeated several times. There's a website, which I was really tempted to pull it up. It's a Morse code translator. And I thought about, what if I just give you my answer in Morse code and it just will start beeping at you? Because that's, you can really see, like, there's this whole sentence going on here. And I got the first letter, but the second and third, you know, it's already beyond me. Bear in mind, she's flying the plane. She's, you know, and they're navigating. Like, it's not even a relaxed situation where they can try really hard. So my feeling is that the Morse code keys that they left behind, they would have been dead weight in the plane. They would not have helped her in any way. And I think she knew that. I think she realized that, well, I'm not going to understand any message given to me, so why bother?
And at this point, Mr. Noonan was unable to get a bearing on the island approximately. I mean, a lot of people would agree that they're approximately 200 miles out from Howland. Did weather play a role in that, you think?
You know, it could have been, because there were some clouds around. It's, dead reckoning is such a frightening and difficult thing to do. I mean, I've flown in modern planes. I have flown trying to use a map and not use my GPS and use dead reckoning and a stopwatch to get to a place, and I was lost in 17 minutes. I mean, you know, and I was convincing myself, oh, well, there's a river and that must be this river. And I was, you know, miles out. I was already completely lost. So if you're out to sea like that, and you really have to be within a good range to be able to see the ship and see the island, I think it's amazing that people ever found any islands, really. I find it much less amazing that they got into a mess. Also with the weather, there were white caps all over the sea. And that's one of the things that has come up, is that the ship was white, the sea was turbulent, and that could have made it harder to see the ship or to see the island. So that would be a weather effect, clouds obviously, but they would be staying well under the clouds as much as they could. I think they were just in the wrong place.
That must have been a desperate moment, I think, if after all this radio transmitting and you know, them not being able to communicate with them, they do get this Morse code, but she just, at this point, her heart must have dropped. She must have known, well, I can't do anything with this, but I can, you know, we're getting it, but we can't proceed. We can't do anything with it. That must have been very desperate at that point for them.
I think that it must have been very, very frightening. I mean, they say also they could hear the fear in her voice in the last calls. And, you know, at some point, just knowing that you don't have any more answers. And what can you do? You can't just keep flying out over the Pacific. That's, you know, clearly suicide. But you're out of options, or you're running out of options very quickly.
So I want to quote something from your book, and then we'll discuss it a little further. The direction finder had failed 2 days earlier during a 30-minute air test at Ley. Earhart found that although she received the operator's signal, she was unable to get a minimum on her direction finder, i.e., she could not get a bearing. So the issue here again was that the direction finding could not respond to such a high frequency. However, Earhart told the general manager at the airport that the failure was because she was too close to the station and the signal was too strong. Now, you mentioned earlier that, you know, sometimes planes crash because pilots make errors. Did Amelia Earhart simply make a mistake or an incorrect assumption regarding the direction finder that ultimately, you know, led to the result of this flight?
I think so. I mean, I think that's a real possibility. I think that's another hole in the cheese where she made an incorrect assumption. As she sort of, she brushed off the issue and did not seem to feel that there was a problem. This is one reason why, although the pilots are the last line of defense, that we have maintenance staff and checks and checklists is so that it isn't so easy for somebody to say, oh, well, it'll be fine. You know, it's a temporary problem. It wasn't clearly not a temporary problem, but it certainly appears not to have been a temporary problem because she couldn't get it working in the plane. And that bit is obvious. So I think there's always this risk of dismissing important details because they're standing in your way. And you want to go, you know, we talk about get their itis. There was huge pressure on her to continue. She'd done, you know, the great majority of the flight. She had 7,000 kilometers to go and she wanted to get going. So this problem she decided was not a problem. And that, I think, seems fairly likely that there really was a problem, as opposed to there were two separate faults, which is less likely.
So let's shift gears a little bit. We'll talk about the smoke plume that the Itasca laid out for the Electra. What do we know about it? Do we know how high that plume went and how long it would have been visible to the Electra in that case?
I don't think there's really strong details. We've got the Itasca said that it stretched for 10 miles, the smoke. But bearing in mind that the Itasca are in the middle of it, I mean, I find it kind of hard to imagine how they could, without a helicopter flying overhead, how they could know what this, you know, how far it stretched and how well it was staying. Certainly, I mean, it was crude oil and that's heavy. So the smoke would have been laying low over the water. We're not talking about like an Indian style smoke signal that's going, you know, straight up. It would have been a blanket of black smoke over the water. That could have been very difficult to see. If there were white caps, that means there was wind. So how long did it last? I don't know. I don't know if anyone's done a reconstruction of this based on, we have the weather reports. We have the location. It should be actually pretty easy to recreate being ship and burning this oil and try and mix. I think somebody should do that.
So as I'm reading through the book and I'm going through reports, various reports that I find online, it appears that Ms. Earhart simply didn't have a proper working knowledge of the required radio communications for a flight of this magnitude. And that may have been the single largest contributed factor to the result of the world flight. I mean, correct me, but am I wrong on that?
No, I think you're right. I think you're correct. The real feeling is that she carried on after she lost her radio operator without having really the knowledge she needed to do to be safe in what she was doing. And again, this goes back to the Swiss cheese model that in a normal world, in a normal flight, it wouldn't have mattered. If Noonan's dead reckoning had been spot on, the fact that they never had any communication with the Itasca wouldn't have mattered one bit because they would have ended up at the right place and they would have landed at Howland. But so then now we've got this issue with multiple things going wrong. If the direction finder had worked but she couldn't hear them, then she might have been able to lock onto their frequency and still be able to find to get the right direction for the navigation. She planned the trip with the expectation of having a competent radio operator. And having planned it this way, she then got the delay when they did the ground loop at Luke field. And so that must have been already very frustrating. She was very driven. She was very dedicated. And she really wanted to make this happen. She was set for, she was getting media attention. She was getting, she was writing a book. There were all these other pressures around her. And she planned it safely. She planned it with a radio operator. When he then dropped out, for whatever reason that Manning dropped out, that threw a wrench in the works. And I think it could be very easy to say, yes, well, we'll have to do without then. So I don't think there was ever an intention to go off half, to go off half-cocked, or to say, well, what, you know, what the hell, we'll be fine. But once things started to go wrong, there wasn't a lot of impetus to say, stop, let's stop and let's think about this. Instead, it's a much more of a, well, the direction finder will be fine. Well, we'll be fine without a radio operator. Well, we'll be fine without Morse code. And, you know, and so it's one decision after another. And each individual decision probably felt very small. But humans, the culmination of these decisions ended up combining to, I think, to ending up in the disaster.
One of our one of the experts that we're featuring in a documentary, Doug Westfall, he has a really relatable way to relay to people what it must have meant, what it must have been like to be in her position looking for Howland. You touched on her fear a little bit earlier. He describes it like this: if you take a ruler and you lay it on the sidewalk outside, and then you walk three houses down, you lay your head on the ground, can you see the ruler? And now if you walk three blocks away and do the same thing, can you see the ruler? That seems to allow people a relatable way to understand that Miss Earhart and Mr. Noonan were dealing with, you know, dropping to about 1,000 feet. They couldn't see an island that was only a few feet off the ground, above sea level. Panic must have been setting in at this point. In your estimation as a pilot, what do you think was going through her mind at that point? I mean, was it just millions of different thoughts? I mean, what was she focusing on? What was she thinking about in your estimation?
I think, well, speaking as a pilot, I think once things start going wrong, the first thing that happens is everything starts to pile up very quickly. And I was taught that it was called running behind the plane, because when things are going well and you know what you're doing and you're feeling confident, then all the different tasks that are involved work out okay. But, you know, I mean, you can do this on a sim where it's like, okay, I'm holding the wings straight and level, and I'm keeping my altitude correct, and so my pitch is correct, and now I'm keeping my speed right. Oh no, there go my wings. Okay, my wings are right. No, my speed's too slow. You know, and there's this constant kind of trying to make sure that all the ducks are in a row type thing. So absolutely, once things start going wrong, you're now getting extra pressure, and you're now running further and further behind the plane. I have no idea what it's like to fly in Electra. I'd love to find out. But I can only imagine that there's a lot, you know, you don't have GPS, you don't have autopilot, you may not have a trim, I don't know. So you're constantly having to deal with all these pieces, and it's using a huge amount of your brain power. You really do not have a lot of brain power left. She must have been thinking about her options at that point. The chances of safely ditching on the Pacific are really low, especially you can see the white caps. It's not going to be a smooth landing. It's not going to be, it's likely, more likely than anything else, that you're going to rip the plane to pieces and yourself in the process. If somehow you manage to land in such a way that the plane doesn't break up on impact, yeah, now you're in the Pacific, it's cold, you're in the middle of nowhere, you couldn't find an island. Who's gonna find your little Electra if it's still floating, you know? So the chances of getting found are very low. Nobody knows where they are. She knows this because she doesn't know where she is, and she's clearly not where she's supposed to be, because otherwise they could see the island. So trying to work out what your options are at that point, you know, you can just feel this kind of narrowing possibilities. And at some point you're going to start thinking, you know, I'm probably going to die. And the last question left is how, you know, am I going to die on impact? Am I going to drown? Am I going to freeze to death sitting on a plane in the water? Am I going to make it to land and then starve to death? You know, none of the options look good. And the chances of being found, she must have known, were very, very low. I think she must have been scared to death.
it's been argued that they were in the vicinity of several other islands in addition to Halland, and that they could have perhaps made a landing attempt on one of those should Halland become unreachable. Given the situation and the amount of the fuel that they're estimated to have had at that point, is it possible or is it even probable that they may have not crashed into the ocean, that they may have in fact been able to lay the plane down on one of those islands?
I think it's certainly possible. Any pilot, you never want to do a water landing if you can possibly avoid it, especially in a small plane, especially in the rough Pacific. So any pilot would be looking for any land. You just don't care what it is. And you're going to be looking to make an emergency landing on that land, look for a beach, or if it's completely, you know, sort of covered with cliffs and mountains, at least you're going to try and ditch the plane in the water near the beach so you have a chance of swimming to it. You are not, you know, the plane's probably not going to float. You need to get to land. So absolutely, if she saw any land at any point, she'd have steered towards it. As soon as she started to be aware that things were going wrong, I think very early on, she probably would have, you know, diverted to say, here is some land. Now, when she was still making the radio calls, she clearly hadn't seen anything because I think she would have said. But from the point of her silence, and she still had fuel when she went silent, she may well have diverted and seen something in the distance and gone for it. And you don't care anymore that it's not Howland. The problem is we don't have enough data to even try to guess where she might have landed. I mean, looking at Air France 447, we're talking about a big old Airbus, and we knew exactly where it had touched the water. I mean, within 40 meters. And it took us 2 years to find the wreckage of that aircraft. It's now, in modern times, not a trivial issue. For her, you know, just even trying to work out what island could she have landed on, we don't know. They were lost. We don't know what went wrong with the Dead Reckoning. The one problem with Dead Reckoning is that it's a cumulative effect. So you make an error, and then this error just kind of gets worse and worse as you go. So if you're heading slightly off or your timing is slightly off, everything starts going wrong from there. And the lack of information, the lack of land beneath them, and the lack of, usually with Dead Reckoning, you work for I'm going to go until I get to this landmark. When I find this landmark, then I'm going to reset everything and I'm going to start over. And they can't do that. So we have no idea at all how far wrong had they gone. There's some estimates. We can look at how much fuel she had, but if we don't know what direction she was flying, it's really difficult to make even a guess. Absolutely, there were islands that she could have made it to, but there's no way of narrowing it down based on her flight information as to what island she might have landed at.
Yeah, you touched on Air France and being within 40 meters. With all of the research that I've been able to do and just a lot of the different various searches, the only thing we know and the only thing I can give people is, well, the area that she landed in is roughly the size of Texas. And so, I mean, it's one of those things where you mentioned finding, you know, a roughly just under a 40-foot aircraft in the middle of a, you know, place like that. Do you think we'll ever find that plane?
If we find that plane or traces of wreckage, it'll be pure luck. And this is something that happens over and over again. There are a lot of missing planes, especially over, that have to do with water crossings, especially where, you know, there's a lack of radar. And Amelia Earhart, interestingly enough, so I started looking at missing planes in general, and I'm making a collection of sort of the most interesting or exciting is the wrong word. I made a collection of the most interesting and confusing missing aircraft. And I thought I would find a lot for the 20s and 30s. And actually what I've got is I've got a very weird air balloon in 1881. And then I've got a missing plane in, I think, 1910 or 1911. And then it goes kind of quiet until Amelia Earhart. And part of the reason for this is that people were flying over populated areas. People were, you know, there were military flights, and now obviously there's not big mystery generally there. And this idea of big water crossings at the time was extremely dangerous and taken with extreme care. And she really is the start of this losing a plane over a large body of water, and that hopeless feeling from our point of view of, and there's nothing we can do. We don't know where she went down. So at this stage, whether or not we can find it is a very, very big question. And a lot of money and efforts already have been put in. So I wouldn't put my money on being able to track it down.
In your opinion, and after all the research that you've done, and just all the time you've put into this, can you tell our listeners what you believe happened to Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan ultimately?
Well, I think it's a little bit depressing. I think it's likely that they continued flying until they ran out of fuel. I'd like to think that they found an island and they were able to land safely and they lived on the beach and they ate crab meat and they were kind of happy for a couple of years, but it just seems really unlikely. There was a huge search effort. I think it was like $4 million poured into just everyone trying, because she was high profile. She was I don't think they would have put anywhere near that amount of effort for a sort of random pilot flying along. But this was in the headlines. This was a media sensation, and the best headline they could have come up with was, "We found her," or failing that, "We found out what happened to her." So yes, it is possible that she was on an island and somehow, when they were searching, doing aerial searches, she wasn't able to build the fire to alert them. She had nothing that she could show them. They did, slow passes trying to find any sign of anyone. It's possible that she was on one of those islands, but it seems to me to be unlikely. It seems much more likely, especially looking at the private searches that have happened since, seems much more likely that the Electra is at the bottom of the ocean and that Earhart and Noonan went down with the aircraft.
2017 marks the 80th anniversary of one of the most popular and fascinating missing persons case, perhaps of all time. Why has the world continued to be so enthralled with Amelia Earhart 80 years after her disappearance?
I think part of it is that people love a mystery. And there's that feeling that, of course, we can work it out. Of course, we can put the pieces, it's like just this really complex puzzle. And we can get enough pieces, we can put it together, and we can make sense of it all. And I've noticed very often that there's just a sense of disbelief. With MH370, I keep having people say to me, like, but they must have found it by now, so clearly someone is hiding it. And you try and get across the scale of the water and the possibilities and the depth and the problems, but there's just still this kind of feeling of utter disbelief. We live in an era of science and technology, and we should be able to get an answer. I think it just feels inconceivable. I think also Earhart herself is just such an amazing person. She was a woman in a time where there were not a lot of options, and she carved her own way and she did what she wanted to do. And I mean, one of my favorite things is that she basically had a prenuptial agreement for when she got married, where she said, look, I'm not going to be faithful. You don't have to be faithful. And if we're unhappy in a year, I want out. And by the way, I'm keeping my name. And it's just like, yes, go. So I think there's also this kind of feeling that she seems like she was an amazing person, and we don't want to see that fail. So, understanding what happened.
Two questions. If she were alive today, what do you think she'd want her legacy to be about and focus on? And what do you think she would think of all the work that's been done and continues to be done to try to, bring her home, so to speak, and kind of put a finite end to this case?
I think she'd be pretty unhappy, actually, because she seems to have been a very controlling personality. She seems, kind of typical type A pilot, she liked making decisions. She knew how she wanted things done. And so I think that looking in at this and seeing the way that her flight and her preparation and her skills were being torn apart, I think would make her pretty unhappy. I think she'd be really frustrated at 80 years having passed without being able to give her own opinion. But that's largely based on, you know, the character in my head that Amelia Earhart has become.
So where can our listeners find out a little more about you and your work and for follow you online? Do you have social media? Where can we kind of follow what you're up to?
So my website is Fear of Landing, and that's fearoflanding.com. And it's an aviation website. It's updated every Friday with accident analysis, but also news and just really whatever interests me. And then there's a Twitter account, Fear of Landing, and there's a Facebook page for Fear of Landing. So, you know, you can follow me on any of those and find out, you know, what's happening or what my latest aviation obsession is. I've also got a book coming out at the end of the year, and it's called Without a Trace, and it will include a chapter on Amelia Earhart, basically a shorter version, but similar to the book that you read. But it also, it goes over 25 different mysteries, and starts in 1881 and it ends in 2016. There's Antonov that disappeared, that we just don't know what happened to it. So so it spans a really great period of, you know, it effectively goes through the entire history of aviation. And specifically is looking at these cases where, what do we know and what are the missing pieces?
Okay. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for sitting in. We really appreciate you being a part of the Chasing Earhart podcast. Thank you very much, Sylvia.
Thank you very much for having me. This has been great.
So that was Sylvia Ridley. We really hope you enjoyed her fresh perspective on the Amelia Earhart investigation. It's a really great kind of way to look at things, and she's got a wealth of knowledge. I would really strongly recommend you guys head over to fearoflanding.com, which is her website that she just kind of plugged on the episode, and it's a great website. It's got a lot of great information on there, and of course follow her on social media. We will hopefully have much more from Sylvia in the future for Chasing Earhart. We're definitely not done with her yet. She's a fascinating woman, and we're very honored to have her. Now, before we head out, as always, I wanted to kind of give everybody a preview of next week's guest. Now, the guest that we have coming up next week is a very interesting one, and this gentleman is somebody I've been wanting to talk to personally for quite some time. Actually, since the inception of this project, I've been wanting to speak with him. He was one of the original 30 individuals that I had on the list to reach out to, and he so graciously gave us a pretty good amount of his time, and that gentleman is Dick Spink. So next week, we will be talking about a lot of different things with Dick Spink. He's a wealth of knowledge in his own right. He kind of has a very interesting backstory, one of my favorite backstories, actually, when it comes to Amelia Earhart and how he sort of got kind of pulled into this thing. He has a really fresh perspective on the Earhart investigation and the Japanese capture hypothesis. And of course, if you are one of the almost 5 million people who watched Amelia Earhart, The Lost Evidence, a couple of months ago, you'll definitely know who Dick Spink is. So we talk about the Japanese capture hypothesis, really kind of what drew him into this particular line of work with Amelia Earhart. We get into the photo, which is a photo that is known as simply as the photo at this point. And we really get into that with him. We talk about kind of the origin of the photo and why he believes the photo is so incredibly important and incredibly credible when it comes to his work and the Japanese capture hypothesis. And it's a really fascinating interview. We're very honored to have Dick aboard, and we really hope you enjoy that episode. That's going to be episode 14 next week, so get ready for that. I think it's an episode that will have a lot of folks talking, and it's really sort of kind of the first official follow-up episode with one of the primary members of Amelia Earhart, The Lost Evidence. So we're very honored and very happy to have him aboard. So until then, 7 days from today, this is Chris Williamson with Chasing Earhart, and thank you so much for joining me, and we will see you in 7 days with Dick Spink.